days of wine and roses.
This is Joanne Salisbury Troxell welcoming you to KGVM and the Poet's Corner. With me today to talk about the renowned poet Wallace Stevens is Steve Kirchhoff. Welcome, Steve.
And thanks
for being here. I know you're a longtime fan of Wallace Stevens, so it seems to me you were in the right place and the right time. What have you got to say for yourself?
Not much, other than that we share a passion for Wallace Stevens, and we have for a long time. First time I ever read a Wallace Stevens poem, I think I was 19 years old. I was a freshman at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, and the American literature professor had us open up to the page in the mentor book of major American poets, and I think we read, our very first poem was something called Domination of Black. And first of all, the title is so striking. Everything about this poet was something as if out of a new world for me. I'd never experienced this kind of thing before. And if you will indulge me, I'd like to talk maybe just for a second about this poem, Domination of Black, and then read
it. Absolutely.
Well, it was included in his 1923 book, Harmonium, which he published not at a tender young age. He didn't start publishing, I think he was 42 when the book came out. In any event, it would have been a far more successful book than it was, and it was successful, but it was on the heels of T.S. Eliot's Wasteland the year before, and so he was competing with some heavyweights and might have been somewhat overlooked. But as you'll hear in this poem, Wallace Stevens announces himself as an American poet who is unique, and for force of language, for eloquence, for themes, for a lot of reasons, Domination of Black is a good place to start. I believe he might be in his well-appointed Hartford home one evening. Probably it's a wintertime scene, and maybe he's in the drawing room by his bedroom upstairs where there's a fireplace, warmed with a fire. Outside, he can see the hemlock tree in his yard, and he can see the leaves of the other trees blowing in the wind. And something comes to him, a cry, it sounds like. Was it a cry from the outside? Was it a cry from the inside? With Wallace Stevens, you never know. But this poem is about the colors, the color that dominates, which is black, and the cry, but gashes through the night, leaving a mark, but being inexplicable as a phenomenon of experience, domination of black. At night, by the fire, the colors of the bushes and of the fallen leaves, repeating themselves, turned in the room, like the leaves themselves turning in the wind. Yes, but the color of the heavy hemlocks came striding, and I remembered the cry of the peacocks. The colors of their tails were like the leaves themselves turning in the wind, in the twilight wind. They swept over the room, just as they flew from the boughs of the hemlocks down to the ground. I heard them cry, the peacocks. Was it a cry against the twilight? Or against the leaves themselves, turning in the wind, turning as the flames turned in the fire, turning as the tails of the peacocks turned in the loud fire, loud as the hemlocks, full of the cry of the peacocks. Or was it a cry against the hemlocks? Out of the window, I saw how the planets gathered, like the leaves themselves, turning in the wind. I saw how the night came striding like the color of the heavy hemlocks. I felt afraid, and I remembered the cry of the peacocks.
Whoa, that's haunting. That's totally haunting. When you were reading that, Steve, I was thinking how Stevens understood something about what is terrifying, hemlocks. The hemlocks are that word, the connotations we have with it. The cry of a peacock is, ah! It is shrill and inhuman as anything in the world and takes us into some unknown territory of the imagination. and that spread of those wings, like the leaves turning. I mean, it's incredible what he's done there.
And what makes it so modern, and why Stevens is called a modernist, is that when he looks out into the world, he seems to have the sense that it's all mechanical. He seems to have inherited the scientific reductionist point of view about nature, that there is no sort of fitting between the human spirit, the human longing, the human meaning, and what happens in the world. You look at this poem, it's not that long a poem, and yet there are so many nouns in it. There's so many things. There's thing after thing after thing. Fire, colors, bushes, leaves, room, wind, hemlocks, cry, peacocks, tails. Thing after thing after thing is geared to every other thing. Mechanically, it all seems to work. But what is the content? What is the inherent value or meaning of it? It seems to have none. And in the precise middle of the poem, the only time he uses the dash as a piece of punctuation, he says, "I heard them cry, dash, the peacocks." As if this cry of the peacocks, it is a cry, right? Humans cry, and nature cries. There is this sort of begging for a kind of identification between the two, right? Like the spirit of nature and the spirit of a human being, but he doesn't allow himself to go there. It's just this frightening, as you were saying, almost like a gothic sense of this gulf between our consciousness, our thirst for meaning, and the contentless and yet perfectly functional natural world that doesn't need us, want us, or care. And so the cry that comes across the night, that comes through the black, that you can't say anything about the black, you can't say anything about the cry, they just were. And I felt afraid, because we're in a place that doesn't care.
Oh, you know, this makes Poe look wimpy. The raven, oh, who cares about the raven? When you think of the surreal world, is here starting with the fire in a cozy study and everything else mingling with the world. My God, it's incredible transcendence, isn't it?
Well, is it transcendence? I think he's thrust back into himself. And what he uses is what the great critic Harold Bloom used to always say was the sort of the sparring match between Wallace Stevens' self-aware mind and incredible eloquence with language, that he was always using language to push back against the weight of reality, as we'll see in another poem that we're going to read. It's always the pushback, right? Because there's this threat that you're going to be engulfed by meaninglessness, and that the awareness of your own meaninglessness as another figure in this meaningless landscape, that in itself is very threatening. And so the poet, like an angel, like a magician, like a hero, summons language to create a moment in time in which the intimations wedded to right words makes you feel okay. Right? I think
wow.
He just wants to feel okay. He's a human being. He wants to feel okay. And I don't think he feels okay a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, he's the human being in that scene. But there's something about it to me that Wallace Stevens is always trying to come to terms with nature in his imagination, too. You know, I mean, it's like he wants us to see reality. But that reality is the peacock and the hemlocks and the imagination. And so there's something that always strikes me when I'm reading Wallace Stevens, like I'm there, but I'm somewhere else. I'm always trying to gather myself to understand and to be there, because it is, in a sense, there but elusive. Mm-hmm. That's the way I feel when I'm reading Stevens. And yet that intrigues me, totally intrigues me, because he has incredible vocabulary, phrasing.
Right.
He's smart.
He's incredible with his phrasing. And so, like, rhetorically, what is he doing? What is the tone? How should you read this poem?
Yes.
Is this resignation? Is this affirmation? Is this a kind of complacency? Is this a sort of an accord that he's made with nature and with these conflicts that he's been carrying around with him day after day? And you have to be very patient with him, and you have to read him for a long, long time. And Harold Bloom always said that he thought Stevens was at least a generation, if not two, ahead of his critical reception. That people weren't ready for what he was bringing. Because his rhetorical skills were just like, whew, they're pretty dazzling.
Yeah, you know, when you say he's the great American poet, and when I read that, I kind of laugh because I think, but what does that mean? What Americans? Who can access him?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's like we talked about that, about is he the great poet for the English teacher, the scholar, or for the common man? And that is the crux of the whole thing, because he is so, in some ways, abstract. At the same time, he's incredibly concrete.
He's very concrete when he says, was it a cry against the twilight? This is the cry of the peacocks. Was it a cry against the hemlocks? Was it a cry against this, that, or the other thing? No, was it a cry against these things that were existing? Yeah. Was it a cry against existence?
Yeah.
Was this a death-like sort of impulse that I felt within myself? Yeah. Because I live in a world which I've convinced myself has no place for me in it.
Yeah.
And also, in the next room is my wife sleeping alone, as she always does, and as I will. We live together, but apart. And there was, I think, a profound loneliness to be with someone day in and day out for half a century and to really not have an intimacy of soul to soul. He had this. He had poetry, and he had plenty of soul. We know that. Should we go on to the next?
Anyway, that is a great way to start this program, Steve. We've got an audience out there that already is hanging on to the peacocks and the hemlocks.
Oh, boy.
A poem that's one of my favorites is The Snowman. And I read this poem every time I open this book. I always read this poem amongst the others. What I like about this poem is the way it begins, how one must have a mind. One must have a mind of winter. To regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow and have been cold a long time. To behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener who listens in the snow. And nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. Incredible.
Wonderful poem. Wonderful.
And you know, the thing is that there is something about that poem, the way it ends, that after all of this conjuring, and then nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. Help me with that. What do you think is going on there?
Well, he has a mind of winter, which means to me, suggests to me that he has purged himself of the pathetic fallacy of English romanticism and does not find any corresponding meaning or answering consciousness in the world. There's no animus mundi.
Yes.
Right, there is nothing that animates this world which likewise animates us, and we can find some sort of way in which we are linked into each other. That's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's the misery. That's the misery until you get used to it. If you have a mind of winter long enough, if you can deconstruct your desire to make meanings in a world which in itself has no inherent meaning, if you can withhold yourself from that activity and adjust yourself to living in this world as it is merely in itself, and you merely in yourself, now you're adapted. I think that's what he's saying. You're a snowman. And it's not miserable, but it's close to misery. Because he says to not think of any misery in the sound of the wind, because you have to get here. This sounds like a poem that's written to someone who wants to learn how to have a consciousness like Wallace Stevens. I'm not sure that many people want that. But it's like a training exercise. Remember that the world is not there to satisfy you. It's not a mirror.
That's right.
It's not an angel. It doesn't link to God. It doesn't link to any transcendent meaning that by conducting yourself in such and such a fashion, with having the right prayers or meditation practices, that you're going to find a way into some sort of blissful realm. That ain't happening. I feel like he's confident enough to say he doesn't think that's real.
That is a real wonderful take on that. And the thing that was really interesting, this idea of the snowman that we conjure up. You know, every child builds a snowman. And that idea that you must have a mind of winter and have been cold a long, long time.
Sad.
It's almost
so
like
sad.
You're hibernating.
Yes, it's so sad.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you can read them on the philosophical level, which we just did, about meaning and meaning of life. And you can read them on the human level. He's been cold. He's been alone.
Yes.
People don't often make snow people. They make a snowman and then go home, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like this solitary figure, right? Made of snow. Where's the blood? Where's the flesh?
Yeah, the carrot for a nose.
Where's the spirit? It's made out of frozen water.
Steve, it's interesting with both these poems that we've been reading here. They are what we call modernist. So let us talk just a moment about that. So I'm thinking about poetry itself, just in the historical sense of the English language. That it starts out, poetry comes before prose. And because the old bards walk around the country singing, strumming their zithers, telling stories. It's all in the oral tradition. And as they tell these stories, they embellish them. And while they might all know some of the same, they might change them somewhat to enhance the tension, to enhance the language, the music that goes with it, and hold people spellbound listening to this. So in the oral tradition, poetry is rhymed because it's easier to remember and people remember it when they hear it. And it is universal. It is the story. It is the history. It is the memory of a culture. It's life. And then the Gutenberg Press comes along, and pretty soon you can print these things. And I remember there was this incredible time in the 60s and 70s when people were going to England and finding out all the folklore, finding out the ones that had never been published, because it was really important to have those down. And then what happened? When they become in the literary tradition, they no longer grow. They stay static. So the modernist comes along, and he's in the tradition where rhyming isn't so important anymore because people aren't memorizing it in that same way. So something more complex starts to take place. The story becomes more complicated, and language becomes more profound in the use of vocabulary and complexity and what the human condition is, because poetry is always looking for meaning in the world. And so that interests me a lot, because Wallace Stevens is definitely that modernist poet that pulls away from those traditions, much like the Romantics did, and then he's even moved further away from them. So would you talk a little bit about that time in which he lived and why that made a difference, the lost generation, whatever?
Whew, that's a lot. Thank you for that summary.
To me, this is important just to get at why he is this poet of this time.
For me, the reason that he's the poet of the mid-20th century is that if you wanted to read him as a modernist, he is questioning the validity of what used to be transcendent ideas that had been taken for granted. That the world was based upon a foundation of ideas, which of course there were atheists at all times in human history, but there were also tremendous numbers of believers, and there was a notion that there was meaning in life, and that we were here with a purpose, that the human species had a purpose, and that each individual within that species had their own personal, private, individual sort of objective in life to fulfill something. And I think that sense of being sort of babies in a cradle, and the cradle's in mm-hmm. on the bosom of the world, that connectedness, I think that was severed. To me, that's modernism. That goes way back to Enlightenment, scientific revolution, the birth of rationality, the valuing of the individual consciousness, right. the breaking apart of the ancient regimes, the starting up of democracies, and all those things that began happening in our world. But then, of course, for me, what makes modernism modernism is World War I, and then the Second World War, the continuation of the same war just a little bit later. And I think that people were completely obliterated in their mentalities and in their spirit. I think that they were just walking wounded people everywhere because it was a devastating war, particularly in Europe, but also in the United States. That, you know, we lost a lot of people in that war. And it was devastating to the idealism that surrounded Eurocentric culture. And so that started to really erode confidence. And you have surrealism, which is just like breaking everything. Everything's already broken, so we're just going to deal with a broken world, right? And there's no sense anymore. And I feel like modernism in verse is kind of a similar thing.
Right.
Stevens has a poem in here that starts somewhere, fat, 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 fat. I am the personal. You are your world. I am mine. Boom. That's like a modernist manifesto. Nothing binds things together anymore. Everything's been ripped apart. Literally, people were ripped apart. Bodies were ripped apart. Buildings, towns, villages, dams, bridges, communications, everything that human beings built, they destroyed with a zest and a vigor that had never been seen before until the Second World War, in which the destruction was even more massive. And that just kills the human spirit. I don't think you can witness that. You can't go through an experience like that without being traumatized for the rest of your life. He didn't go through that. But he cavorted with people who were much closer to it. And a lot of those avant-garde artistic types were refugees from war. Anyway, right. That's my take on modernism, is like a kind of a collapse of the confidence in the scientific / democratic principles that were going to guide life. We had it somehow, and then we totally undermined it.
That's amazing. And here we have Wallace Stevens, out of that zeitgeist of that time. And also such an educated man. When he was 12 years old, going to high school, read the Greek and the Latin, took those things. And you know, it reminded me that it wasn't that long ago that we taught those in high schools. Mm-hmm. And then gradually it became defunct. Yeah. And that was another way of getting rid of that to a new kind of world.
Yeah.
So I remember Latin taught at Bozeman Senior High, the first year I taught there.
Yeah, I took Latin 1, I think, and 2. I don't really remember.
A Latin scholar.
Oh, right, yeah.
Well, read your next poem.
So the next poem that we were going to talk about is one called The American Sublime. And I'm not sure if this comes from Harmonium or Transport to Summer, which was his next volume of poem. I think it might have been toward the end of Harmonium. But in any event, it doesn't really matter. It's just a poem called The American Sublime, which in a way is a kind of posing the question that we're in a way sort of chasing the tail of right now, which is, what does it mean to lift American life to a kind of next level of turning it into something that we know what it is, turning it into something that produces values that we can emulate? What is it to have a culture? And if we have a culture that we can believe in that gives us goals, there could be a sublimity in America. But I think he has an ironic tone here about the American sublime. The American sublime. How does one stand to behold the sublime? To confront the mockers, the Mickey mockers, and plated pears. When General Jackson posed for his statue, he knew how one feels. Shall a man go barefoot, blinking and blank? But how does one feel? One grows used to the weather, the landscape and that, and the sublime comes down to the spirit itself. The spirit and space. The empty spirit in vacant space. What wine does one drink? What bread does one eat? The end. So many tones in that. And here it is where, we were talking about the poet as an individual, living an individual life, and modernism as kind of a further development of individuality, idiosyncratic ways of the individual spirit of expressing itself. That's something that modernism values, right? Values personal expression. And yet, at the same time, there's always a pull, because we're human beings, we're group animals, there's always a pull to live by the symbolic order in which we live. The symbolic order of the church, of the government, of the laws, of the rules, of the other poets, of the other writers, of the traffic rules that we have to follow as we go around, of what are the laws regarding our desire, what are the laws regarding the fulfillments of our desires, what are the laws governing all of this stuff. We find it in our language. We find it in our group interactings with each other, our minglings with each other. We have rules, we have red lights and green lights, and the symbolic order is always there. And yet, that runs up against the individual, because how do I define myself, which is not in a way kowtowing to the symbolic order? Is there a way to live your life in a sublime fashion in a group setting? How do you do that? What would it be? What would it be to become a sublime figure? And I think this General Jackson, right, posing for his statue, he says here, he knew that as General Jackson knew how one feels. How does one feel as you're posing for your statue? Oh, they're getting me right? Oh, they know every nuance of my amazingly strange perspective of life? They know about my secrets? Do they know my failures? Do they know my doubts? Do they know who I am as a human? No. They're going to put me on a massive horse. I'm sure to have a sidearm and a sword and my hat. Now I'm posing for a statue. Is this what it is to become sublime in our culture? And so I feel like there's that whole notion of the symbolic order. Nature doesn't read us. The symbolic order doesn't read us. We're really alone. Wallace Stevens is so alone because he doesn't necessarily have any accord with people around him.
No.
And he thinks of himself as an angel sometimes. He's posing here as the general. He poses as the poet. He poses as the philosopher. He poses as the lover. Poses as the explorer. And he's always trying to find the way to get peace, love, and feelings of life. He wants to be alive. He wants to feel love. He's a human being, right? Isn't that what we want? And yet he's drawn into all these things. He's drawn into this game. He's drawn into this world of words. And how does one pose? How does one confront the symbolic order? How do you confront your neighbors? How do you confront public opinion? How do you confront everything? What is it that we do in America? How do we manage this? It's a kind of a real basic question, but it's an interesting one that we fairly often don't think that much about. The spirit and space. Look how this reality gets pared down to the spirit and space. Wait, not just any space, an empty spirit in a vacant space. When you get to this point, everything becomes a building up from the very bedrock. What wine does one drink? What bread does one eat? What does one do? I've reduced it down to everything. Now what?
I'm so glad you're here, Steve, because you give a lot of life to these poems. You give so much meaning and texture to them. And that isn't always easy to get. And so someone like yourself, it's sort of unusual and such a pleasure to have you here reading.
That's a lovely thing for you to say. I appreciate it. I really do.
Yeah,
thank you.
Well,
oh, you want to read Angel?
Yes, because I want to know what Paisans are.
Paisans are country folk. It's like paisano.
I thought first peasants.
Person from the countryside, like a rough, uneducated bumpkin type. Wallace Stevens is not above having contempt for ordinary people. Ordinary is a word that you find in his poems a lot, and he always has an ambivalent relationship to it, because I feel like he lived a fairly vexed life emotionally, so he would like to be ordinary. There would be a great satisfaction in being able to feel tranquil. And yet, to be ordinary would mean that you would fall under the sway and the thrall of the symbolic order, and you'd just be pushed around by life, and you wouldn't be uncovering what it is he's trying to uncover with his amazing layers of language. Yeah, he's trying to uncover with a layer. Go figure. That's what happens when you have a mind of winter. Angel surrounded by paisans. Here it says in italics, one of the countrymen, colon, because the countryman's going to speak. The countryman says, there is a welcome at the door to which no one comes. Apparently the angel doesn't appear immediately. The angel now speaks. I am the angel of reality, seen for a moment, standing in the door. I have neither ashen wing nor wear of ore, and live without a tepid aureole, or stars that follow me not to attend, but of my being and its knowing part. I am one of you, and being one of you is being and knowing what I am and know. Yet I'm the necessary angel of earth, since in my sight you see the earth again, cleared of its stiff and stubborn man-locked set, and in my hearing you hear its tragic drone rise liquidly in liquid lingerings, like watery words awash, like meanings said by repetitions of half-meanings. Am I not myself only half of a figure of a sort? A figure half seen or seen for a moment, a man of the mind, an apparition apparelled in apparels of such lightest look that a turn of my shoulders and quickly, too quickly, I am gone?
That poem is intriguing because there's something about a spiritual experience that can happen right here. It doesn't have to be up in heaven or something. It can happen right here. I always have a problem when he talks there about reality. And at the same time, he's always talking about imagination. So how does he make that reality and imagination? Do we miss reality because we don't see it enough? We don't look at it enough? What is it? Because that poem intrigues the hell out of me.
I think he might say we don't see reality because all we see is our self-obsessed notions. We're always out searching for something. We're always in the pursuit. We're driven to find something in this world. We're looking for satisfaction. We're looking for love. We're looking for money. We're looking for reputation. We're looking to cure our reputation. We're looking to have a new friend. We're looking to get rid of a situation that we're in. Whatever it is, we're always looking, grasping, moving. And what do we see in this world, which is so cluttered with machinations and motivations and words, mm-hmm. that we see things that aren't there? That's how we are motivated. So yeah, I think that's what he says is, I guess the psychological word would be that we project it, or we can't help ourselves. We are impelled to seek for something. Sometimes we're seeking just after seeking because we don't know what else to do. And we have this energy and we keep coming up against something. We keep coming up against the reality. And the reality is so much bigger than we are and so ill-concerned with us that it's hard. It's hard. We live by inspiration. We live moment to moment. We live by these intimations that he talks about and these feelings of, I guess, a kind of personal power. Because that's what I think what he gets when he's writing well. I think he gets the power that pushes back against the force of reality so that he has a space where he can feel okay.
That's really, really interesting. That whole poem, I go back to that and keep reading it because there is something about that. And it makes me think, say, about the nature of our nature and reality, and that we're like in a huge distraction from that reality with trivia. And yet, there is out there that larger, more meaningful, and we miss it. And when he says, it stands in the doorway.
And it's like a liminal figure, right? Like, yeah. He's holding himself up in his, what he does with his life, his endeavoring in life to find in language a kind of relenting of the pain of reality. What he finds in language, is he's offering to you. He says that he's the poet of the earth, because I guess that's where he wants to fix his gaze. He could be the poet of relationships. He could be the poet of the sailor. He could be the poet of the working person. But he wants to be the poet of the earth. Okay, fine. Go ahead and be the poet of the earth. He's like, I want to be the poet of the earth for you so that you can see the earth without the symbolic order intruding on it. You can see the earth as it is in and of itself without all those other trappings. That seems to be his project. I'm not sure everybody wants that. Wants that delivered to them, right? But his language is so beautiful. I found it worth it. I've been reading his poetry for 40 years.
Because you still got the hemlocks and the peacocks.
Yeah. He wrote a book of essays based on this line here, I'm the Necessary Angel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, The Necessary Angel was the title of his book of essays. The Necessary Angel of the Earth, because in my sight you see the earth again. So this is like the poet offering the poet's services to the reader. This seems like a direct address to the reader. The paisans are you and me, the readers. and he's telling us what he has to offer. These are the goods that I have. I'm going to give you these little glimpses of things. I'm going to give you half meanings. I'm going to give you a look into nature that maybe is going to make you feel good because of this wonderful way that I put the language together. I hope so, because that's what I do, kind of thing.
Do you think that there is some kind of paradox between fearing nature and also looking at nature as the ultimate reality? Does he have any kind of tension between that?
Yeah, I think there's tension there for sure. Because I think he's moved by nature. And yet he has that reductivist point of view about nature, that it's mechanical, that Darwin already explained it for us. There's no more investigation required. The whole thing works without a God. The whole thing follows certain guidelines and laws that are encoded in the genes. So what do we need to do in terms of like relating to the earth? It's like relating to a machine, right? And he uses the word machine often in here. And things mechanical go around. And he sees that the world works perfectly well. So he's amazed by this thing and needs it. It's just it took him a long time to finally break his rationalistic hold on reality. You want to read a poem where he does? Where his rationality gives way to something more generative, something more emotional, something more unifying?
You know, he worked for Hartford, ended up being vice president. And when you think of that, and I remember reading some places, somebody that he worked with heard that he wrote poetry. And he said, "Wally? Wally is a poet?" And I thought, I can imagine that. Because I've always thought, how do you go and do that mundane kind of organized work? It's very organized, very specific.
Not particularly nice to people either.
No, not really.
Right?
I mean, how can we save another money here? And thinking in big cities, the tall buildings that are the insurance, especially Hartford. And I always want there to be a contradiction, and yet I have never read that there was a contradiction between his work as a lawyer for Hartford and his poetry. I've never heard a contradiction that he said he would rather write always, but he had to be practical. He had to make a living. So he went into law after Harvard. And I always loved the way that when he went to Harvard, that he had to quit because they ran out of money. And he said, "Well, I didn't think the Harvard literature program was all that good anyway." And I just want to laugh at that because he was way over it,
mm-hmm.
way over it already. Mm-hmm. Motive or metaphor. I love metaphors, by the way, so I'd like to have a motive for them, everyone. So here it is. "You like it under the trees in autumn because everything is half dead. The wind moves like a cripple among the leaves and repeats words without meaning. In the same way, you were happy in spring with the half colors of quarter things, the slightly brighter sky, the melting clouds, the single bird, the obscure moon. The obscure moon lighting an obscure world of things that would never be quite expressed. Where you yourself were never quite yourself and did not want to have to be. During the accelerations of changes, the motive for metaphor shrinking from the weight of primary noon, the ABC of being. The ruddy temper, the hammer of red and blue, the hated sound, steel against intimations, the sharp flash, the vital, arrogant, fatal, dominant X."
Boom. Down comes the hammer.
It is that ending. Always surprises me because it takes you out of the niceties of the metaphor mm-hmm. into something sharper, more real, more necessary. What's your take on it?
Yeah, the vital, arrogant, fatal, dominant X. that's reality, right?
Yeah.
It's vital because it's alive. It's arrogant because it knows more and can do more. It's fatal because it takes our lives, and it's dominant. There's nothing we can do about it. And it's unknowable, therefore it's just an X. It's just letters of the alphabet. That's all you can say about some of these things. If you're going to use a metaphor for reality, ABC of being will do, right? That's the metaphor for reality. And here's the weight of reality. It's pressing down on us. And what do we have to press back with? We have our language. We have our intimations, right? What is that hammer hammering against? Steel against intimation. That's what we get to defend ourselves with. Intimations couched in language. That's poetry, according to Wallace Stevens. That's what motivates us, and that's what saves us from, I think, more unhappiness than is probably already being felt. You see, there's just no reciprocity between reality and human existence.
Yeah.
There's an antagonism. I came across this quote in a book I was reading about whether or not plants have intelligence and consciousness.
Yeah.
And here's a quote from Alexander von Humboldt, a 19th century naturalist. Maybe you know this person. I've never read his stuff. But he was quoted in this book that I was reading called The Light Eaters, about plants. And Humboldt says, "Nature speaks to man in a voice that is familiar to his soul." Now, Wallace Stevens would never say that. Or maybe he would. Maybe he would. Would he say this, though? "Everything is interaction and reciprocal. And therefore, nature gives the impression of the whole." Maybe Wallace is closer to that than I thought. But when I first read that, I was like, that is such a foil to Wallace Stevens, because Wallace Stevens sees nature as the dominant X, right? Or reality, the reality of nature, I guess, is what he means. But here we have someone saying, no, we actually are reciprocally influencing each other. We are in a relationship, and it is a relationship for us in our human existence of meaning. We don't know what the meaning is for plants yet, or if there is one yet. We don't know these things because of our own ignorance, but surely there's stuff going on. Anyone who's had an experience in nature that alters your perspective, you don't need to be told, taught, you don't learn it. It's not a question of rationality or science. If you've had an experience in which you know that nature is alive and conscious, then you've had it. And it seems to me sorrowfully that Wallace never had that, man. I think he lived in suburban Connecticut. Maybe it's hard to have a great experience there in nature, but maybe not either. I don't know. But it just doesn't strike me that he had that kind of thing. He went to Key West. He sailed all the way around Mexico, you know, all the way around the Pacific side of it. And he got out. I don't know how much of a European traveler he was, but I wish he could have had an experience in nature that rocked his world.
His most famous poem, do you know what it is considered?
Yeah, The Idea of Order at Key West, right?
No? Sunday Morning.
Oh, Sunday Morning.
And that line from Sunday Morning, death is the mother of beauty. The thing about Stevens, he's meditation. For me, he's like, I think about death is the mother of beauty, okay, and it beauty never dies. And how does that work? And it's like he makes you ponder the nature of your own reality, how that you think about things. And I think that in reading Wallace Stevens, you become almost transformed yourself in ways.
Mm-hmm.
That he's transformed himself into who he is, because that's what he says at the end. I made myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow. And Bloom saying, the best and most representative American poet of our time, Wallace Stevens. What does this mean in the light of the obscurity of his poems for the average American reader? And that is for time to tell, Steve. I mean, he's here. And I think that there is something immortal about him.
Mm-hmm. What they said about him, I think that I've seen people talking about Stevens, and they said he's a poet's poet. Not a people's poet, a poet's poet. And that might be a fair... Is that a criticism? Maybe. It's kind of an elitism. Because he had an elite intellect, and he had an elite facility with language. You put those two things together, no wonder he has a hard time relating to the paisans. No, but he does. He has a hard time somewhat relating to other people, I think, sometimes. And yet, I think he really has a beautiful conclusion to his poetical career. That final book of poems called The Rock. shows so much range of just beautiful, simple, real human feeling. You want to read a poem that has beautiful feeling in it? I'm thinking about this poem, Final Soliloquy of the Interior Paramour.
Okay. Final Soliloquy of the Interior Paramour. Light, the first light of evening, is in a room in which we rest, and, for small reason, think the world imagined in the ultimate good.
This is, therefore, the intensest rendezvous. It is in that thought that we collect ourselves, out of all the indifferences, into one thing.
Within a single thing, a single shawl wrapped tightly round us, since we are poor, a warmth, a light, a power, the miraculous influence.
Here, now, we forget each other and ourselves. We forget the obscurity of an order, a whole, a knowledge, that which arranged the rendezvous.
Within his vital boundary in the mind, we say God and the imagination are one. How high that highest candle lights the dark.
Out of the same light, out of the central mind, we make a dwelling in the evening air, in which being there, together, is enough.
Thank you so much for being here, Steve, today.
My pleasure.
It's been such a wonderful, wonderful time.
I just wanted to say that this poem, for me, brings Wallace Stevens to a new place.
Yes.
Right? There's communion here.
Yes.
And he says, I'm not going to fight anymore with reality. Because reality and what the imagination in my mind, I'm just going to let them be as one. I'm going to allow there to be a kind of linking of what's outer and what's inner. I'm just going to be okay with that, right?
It is indeed the perfect way to end a session about, sort of summarizes so well what he's about. And there will always be some boundary somewhere. Can language ever really get to it, Steve? That's what he wants more than anything, the imagination and language to be fulfilling the desire of the poet. Can we ever do it?
That reminds me of a quote by Edith Cobb, also quoted in The Light Eaters. She says, the eternal questioning of the nature of the real is largely a wordless dialectic between self and world. So in other words, it's beyond language, it's without language. Even to hold up language as the mediator between me and the real is to give language the mystifying power, right? Is to turn it into an illusion. Language can't give you that, and he also knew that. And I feel like what he's saying here is, I just want to be with you. I just want to be next to you, and I want there to be a candle. And I want to sit there with you. I just want to be with you. Can we be together?
On August 2nd, 1955, the great American poet Wallace Stevens died at St. Francis Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut. He was 75 and had stomach cancer. He had won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry that same year and had been an insurance executive at the Hartford for decades. Quiet and reclusive, he was often seen deep in thought as he walked from his home near Elizabeth Park to his offices at the insurance company. Thank you, Steve Kirchhoff, for being here today. Such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
This is Joanne Salisbury Troxell for the Poet's Corner. Have a sip of wine, smell the roses, and read a poem. Thanks for listening. Bye now.
Bye.
The days of wine and roses. Laugh and run away. Like a child at pain.